And a bit more stamping going on in the hall here. I don't really need to say anything. Well, all that's going on. You can hear how enthusiastic the Proms audience is here tonight. But as I said, it's another chance to enjoy Joseph Calea's singing. This year at the Proms in the Park, when he returns in the wake of his appearance at the last night of the Proms last year. You may remember him sporting a particularly fine tracksuit on that occasion. Will he be lured back? Well, yes, here he comes. He was saying earlier that it's particularly special for him to perform here at the Royal Albert Hall. And he's only sorry that his late father couldn't be here to see the occasion. It would have given him such a thrill. And he turns to audience and orchestra, blows kisses. He's a multi-award-winning artist too. His international career was launched when he won the Hans Gabor Belvedere singing competition. And Milan has played a very important part in his career too. He won the Caruso competition there in 1998. And he's something of a protege for Placido Domingo as well, of whom he speaks very fondly. Well, Joseph Calea makes his way off stage now, and from Verdi, the orchestra will turn its attention in 20 minutes or so to Tchaikovsky. That's in the second half of the concert. Xianzhang conducts the Manfred Symphony to conclude this season's complete Tchaikovsky symphony cycle. But we're staying with Verdi for a little longer in tonight's Proms Plus intro, which took place earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from the Royal Albert Hall. It's introduced by Ian Skelly.
Now, there's been much talk at the Proms this season about Wagner and the way of telling a story with the orchestra. Wagner famously saw the orchestra as the chorus in a Greek tragedy, with all the characters effectively depicted within the orchestration using his famous weave of leitmotifs. But what of his exact contemporary, the man whose music we're enjoying tonight at the BBC Proms, Giuseppe Verdi? Is it all about the voice with Verdi, or can we learn a thing or two if we take a closer look at the way he employed the orchestra? Just as with Wagner, Verdi had a great influence over the development of the orchestra, something that Tchaikovsky was to benefit from, especially when he came to his great brooding Manfred Symphony. Or did such developments enable the cult of the romantic hero to find its true voice? To unpack all of that is Claire Holden, who's a member of the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. She regularly plays with plenty of other early music groups and is someone who is passionate about the history of performance practice. She's a research fellow at Cardiff University, specializing in early 19th century string playing. And alongside her, Professor Jonathan Bate, provost of Worcester College, Oxford, writer, playwright, broadcaster, a leading expert on the entire Romantic movement. And a fan of Verdi too?
Oh, definitely a fan of Verdi, especially, of course, his Shakespearean operas. But yeah, I mean, the thing about Verdi is that he is central to the Romantic movement, that although you think of Romanticism more with Wagner, the Germans, Northern Europe, but one of the key aspects of the Romantic movement was the way in which, in the 19th century, literature, music, and painting were used by creative artists who were involved in a process of shaping a sense of national identity. Sir Walter Scott, the great novelist of Scottish identity, was hugely influential. Verdi absolutely loved Scott. And of course, across Europe, there were many operas based on Scott. So that aspect of Verdi that is to do with the sense of an Italian national consciousness, a national identity, his involvement with the Risorgimento, the union of Italy, all that's very much at the core of Romanticism.
We'll come back to all of that, but let's just start with the orchestra and with Claire. Give us a picture, if you would, of what the orchestra was like then when Verdi started out and how it then developed.
Well, much smaller than it was towards the end of his life. During Verdi's career, the the orchestra in La Scala almost doubled in size. One of the very noticeable things when Verdi started writing was Italian orchestras had very, very few cellos compared to what we're used to today. You'd quite often find orchestras that had more than twice as many double basses as cellos. Some orchestras might only have two cellos. I think La Scala had four cellos and eight basses at the beginning. And Verdi is very interested in the development of the orchestra. He's very full of ideas and influences from travels abroad on how Italian orchestras can be improved and enlarged. There's quite a lot of letters go backward and forward between Verdi and Ricordi, his publisher, saying, I couldn't conceive of letting the new opera be performed at such a theatre because those viola players were absolutely shocking last time. Or, yes, okay, they can have the opera, but they must get more cellos in to boost the section. And the other thing that's worth remembering about most of Verdi's career is that there wouldn't have been an interpretive conductor in the way that we're so used to today. The first conducting without a violin bow being in use didn't happen in Italy till 1860, so really quite late.
Was Verdi very interested in using the orchestra to move the drama on, or was he more interested in the voice doing that?
No, I think we know of Verdi being this hugely important dramatist, but actually one of the things that is really key in that is the function of the orchestra. By the end of Verdi's career, he's really using the instruments in a way that they're almost like an extra character. What the instruments do is tell us more about the emotional states of the characters than the singers themselves can. So you'll hear things in the instrumentation. You know, it might be a sob, it might be a sigh. And this becomes more and more as his style develops and you go through the second, third periods. And by the time you get to Otello and then to Falstaff, you really see that this is, a real expert.
So let's leap forward then to the very end of his career, to 1893, to his last opera, Falstaff. You've got an example here where there's so much of that coming to maturity, lots of wit as well within the orchestra. Could you just talk us through what we're going to hear?
The bit we're going to hear, Falstaff has just been bragging to Ford that he's got an... He doesn't know that Ford is Ford. He's just been bragging that he's got an assignation to seduce Mrs. Ford that afternoon. So Ford's pretending to be someone else. He has to be all nice to Falstaff. Falstaff leaves the stage, and at this point, Ford gets into a rage of anger, which turns into self-pity. And just at the moment, he's feeling most sorry for himself, and he's indulging in all this personal angst, we get these horns which are like straight from Mahler, and it's really tappy. It's just poking very gentle fun at the whole kind of angst-ridden self-obsession of the kind of North European German kind of music of that time. So.
Master Ford, Master Ford, hurry me! Svegliati, su, ti presto, tua moglie sparta, e metti in palazzo, l'onor tuo, la tua casa, e il tuo. Thank you.
marvellous stuff. The OAE, as you say, has been playing Verdi all summer. What does it reveal about Verdi when you're playing with authentic instruments? Is it easier to get the balance, actually, with authentic instruments?
Absolutely, actually. I mean, the gut strings sort of have a different sound about them, which makes it much easier for the singers to penetrate over the top without forcing. You've got narrow bored wind and brass instruments, which make it a different sound. And Verdi was very specific about the sound he wanted. It's very clear. One of his pet hates was tubas. Really didn't like them. Mainly because he thought they didn't blend, but he's also slightly biased against conical brass instruments anyway, because they seem to be coming from the German-Austrian musical tradition, which goes back to all these ideas of the Risorgimento and that actually they want something to break away from this kind of oppression that they've associated with Austrian invasion and things like that. So he's very specific about that. So one of the delightful things when you do it on period instruments is that you get this wonderful looking thing called a cimbasso, which is what Verdi intended it to be performed on. And it's sort of, it's like a hybrid. It works a bit more like an ophicleide than a tuba, but it's kind of like a super basso trombone that's kind of turned on its side, and it makes a really extraordinary and wonderful noise. So the colours, I think, is the main thing about
it. And Verdi did, of course, write a couple of operas that were somewhat Byronic, weren't they, Jonathan?
Well, not just somewhat Byronic, they were dramatisations of narrative poems by Lord Byron. Well, in one case a narrative poem, in another a play. The Corsair was a tremendously popular poem of Byron's. It actually sold 20,000 copies on the day it was published. It was the best-selling poem in history when it came out. It has a pirate and a lover. Verdi turned that into an opera. And then Byron also wrote a number of plays, which were quite successful on stage at Drury Lane. One of them, The Two Foscari, about rival doges in Renaissance Venice. And that's another one that Verdi turned to an opera.
Just link us, if you would, Lord Byron with Romanticism, because one's sort of got both of them in one's head at the same time. I'm not quite sure which comes first, chicken or egg.
Well, I mean,
Romanticism
comes first, and Lord Byron is the apogee of it. Byron said, poetry is the lava of the imagination. And that's kind of as good a definition of Romanticism as you get. Romanticism, a movement partly stimulated by the French Revolution, a revolutionary movement across all the arts, literature, theatre, music, painting, really takes off in the late 18th century, initially in Germany and Britain, and then expands across Europe, in which creative art becomes about self-expression, an explosion of the imagination. Artists are interested in passion, in their feelings, they're going back to nature, whereas so much 18th century art is very, very civic, very much of the community and the city, very harmonious, symmetrical, all that's thrown away. It's back to nature, back to the feelings, back to the self. One of Byron's contemporaries said he was the first artist in history to make himself the subject of everything that he wrote. And so whenever one has an image of a 19th century creative artist, you know, passionately alone in their garret, I mean, Hector Berlioz's memoirs, I think, are one of the great texts that give you an idea of what the romantic artist is like. The artist is compelled to write. It's as if he's taken over, he or indeed sometimes she, is taken over by a sort of demonic spirit, and there's that great volcanic explosion of imagination.
So therefore, do we read Manfred for Byron, because it was written after a particularly eruptive episode in his life?
We do indeed, yeah. Manfred is a key work in Byron's life and career. What So just to explain the origins of this, in 1816, Byron's short-lived marriage to Annabella Milbank collapses. There's a very strong rumour, which is almost certainly true, that the reason the marriage has collapsed is because he's been having an affair with his half-sister, Augusta. She did actually go with them on their honeymoon. It was the greatest scandal in Regency London, and Byron was effectively drummed out of the country. He goes into exile. He actually goes to the shores of Lake Geneva, and it's then that he famously meets up with the Shelleys, and you have the night when they tell ghost stories and Mary Shelley writes Frankenstein. Whether or not you take the autobiographical line, there's no doubt that Manfred, alone in the mountains, passionate, communing with nature, tortured, melancholic, he is the archetypal romantic figure, and everybody identified him with Byron. He doesn't want forgiveness, he wants forgetfulness. Interestingly, at the end of the poem, he's not forgiven, but he ends up committing suicide. When we come to Tchaikovsky's symphony, in terms of the programme of the symphony, there's a quite significant change in that the figure of the spirit or ghost of Astarte, his lost love, does pardon him and forgive him. The ending is rather softened.
And, of course, I would imagine, heavy in his mind are other composers who have taken this theme as well, not least Berlioz. We've got a little excerpt from Berlioz's Harold in Italy. Perhaps you could just talk us into that and what the significance was at the time of this piece.
Yeah, this I mean, Berlioz, I think, is the key figure for explaining the origins of Tchaikovsky's Manfred. Berlioz, you know, the most literary of all the great romantic composers, obsessed with Shakespeare, but also with Byron. And he wrote Harold in Italy, which is based on Byron's poem, Childe Harold's Pilgrimage. That was the poem Byron said, I awoke and found myself famous. It was the poem that made him into the European celebrity he became. A great piece of programme music, like, you know, opera without voices, tells the story of the poem.
Let's just hear Berlioz to begin, and then we can come on to the Tchaikovsky.
Berlioz conducted that in Russia late in his life in the late 1560s, and everybody in Russian musical society got really excited about this idea of a Byronic piece of program music. And that then led a critic of the time to suggest to a Russian composer called Balakirev, who was a friend of Tchaikovsky's, that he should write a Manfred symphony sort of in the style of Berlioz's Harold in Italy. He didn't do it. They actually asked Berlioz if he'd like to do it himself. He said he was too old. Many years passed, and eventually Balakirev kind of gave the idea to Tchaikovsky, and that's how it originated. Eventually, when he did do it, he absolutely threw himself into it and felt that it was one of his greatest achievements. I think one of the things that made him hesitate was the fact that Schumann had been there before In the 1840s, Schumann wrote an overture and incidental music for a staged production of Manfred, though, as I say, Byron wrote it for what he called a theatre of the imagination. It was staged in Germany in the 1840s with wonderful music by Schumann. There's a fantastic story of someone in the audience who later wrote a memoir of Schumann saying that when Schumann was conducting the overture of Manfred, before the very eyes of the audience, Schumann became Manfred. That idea of the artist becoming this tortured character, Manfred. Tchaikovsky, at some level, because his own feelings, his own sort of tortured life, bore up upon him. Perhaps he was almost afraid of becoming Manfred himself. He was going to go into a very dark place.
It's very interesting because he did regard it as one of his best works. Then he actually threatened to destroy it because he started to hate it. And it has had, Claire, a somewhat checkered history in its performance. I think it was Toscanini who thought it was the greatest piece that Tchaikovsky had ever written. Bernstein called it trash. What's wrong with it? I mean, what's your feeling as a player? What's difficult about it that makes it so rarely performed?
Well, it is difficult, is one of the main things. It's much more technically challenging than any of the symphonic writing that he'd come up with before then. It's also, you know, it's big. It's quite an undertaking. You've got the best part of an hour, sometimes, you know, depending who's conducting it, can tip over the hour mark, and the four movement form of it is a kind of very important component of what Tchaikovsky was doing, but somehow structurally he didn't quite nail it. Particularly in the later movements, it's so free, the structure and inventive, that actually somehow it just doesn't quite sit satisfactorily to some people. I got to say, I'd put myself in that camp.
I think you're right. I think it does go awry in the second half, as it were. But I think the first two movements are wonderful. I mean, I think the thing to hold in your mind's eye in the first movement is the figure of Manfred alone in the mountains. You know that wonderful Caspar David Friedrich yes. picture of the wanderer high on the mountaintop? That's the image to hold in your mind's eye as you hear the first movement. And then the second movement is beautifully light. It's Manfred's dialogue with a spirit of... I was going to say a rainbow, but actually Byron's word in the poem is a sunbow. That's to say there's a waterfall with a reflection coming from the sun above it. And it's beautifully light. And I think those first two movements are fantastic. But I do agree with Claire, there is a bit of a problem with the last movement.
Claire Holden, Jonathan Bate, thank you both very much indeed.
That was an edited version of the Proms Plus event held earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. It was introduced by Ian Skelly and produced by Helen Garrison. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Penny Gore, live on BBC Radio 3 and online in high-definition sound. Well, after the Orchestra Sinfonica di Milano Giuseppe Verdi's tribute to their namesake in the first half of the concert, they turn, as we've heard, to another composer we've been focusing on throughout this prom season. 2013's Tchaikovsky Symphony Cycle reaches its towering finale with Manfred, based on an epic poem by Lord Byron. Conductor Xian Zhang is definitely one of the work's champions.
About this piece, there's a lot of controversy. Some people hate it. Some conductors, like Bernstein, he didn't like it. Conductors like Toscanini loved it. But he did huge revisions, he did huge cuts. Its length is very long. With program music, that itself, as a fact, is already very difficult to manage. Rather than a long symphony, the music has to go according to the story or to the poem, to whatever it's written for. So for that, it's difficult. But the music itself is lyrical, dramatic. I think it's a beautiful work.
Xian Zhang. Well, as we heard in the interval, the idea for setting Byron's poem came from Balakirev, mentor to so many young Russian composers in the 19th century. But Tchaikovsky took a while to come round to the idea of writing this symphony. He eventually agreed, though, and started work in the spring of 1885. He quickly became enthusiastic. He told a friend he was captivated. "I cannot remember ever having felt such pleasure in working." And the result, this four-movement piece for huge orchestra, tracing the protagonist's anguished wanderings through the Alps as he mourns the death of his beloved. And here to conduct Tchaikovsky's Manfred Symphony is Xianzhang, music director of the orchestra La Verdi.